As with Terry last week, I don't have a PowerPoint presentation. Though not for the same reasons, obviously. In chapter 6 of the book of Hebrews, you started studying in verse 9, and it was Terry's intent last week to go from 9 through 20, but he did much like I do and went from 9 to 13, near as I can tell, 9 to 12, actually. just started introducing verse 13. So what I wanted to do, though, is I wanted for us to go through just a little bit in a generalized review of what we've looked at so far. Now, when we think of the book of Hebrews, there's a word that's used frequently in there that sort of describes what the writer is talking about. What word is that word? Used 13 times in the book. Better. Okay. He uses the word better a number of times, almost in every chapter, to describe what he's talking about in the in his letter to the Hebrews. Now, what is the purpose of him describing the things that he's talking about as better? I mean, what? Why? Why does he use the word better? It better is sort of a comparative term, is it not, Randy? All right, the Old Covenant with the New Covenant. And why is he comparing the Old Covenant with the New Covenant?
Some are wanting to go back to the old ways of Judaism.
Okay. Roy, was that pretty much what you had?
Yeah.
Yeah. They were trying to go back, some of them anyway, appeared to be trying to go back to the ways of Judaism rather than this better covenant that they had that he's speaking about here. Now, as I mentioned in my class, one of the things that I think sort of has a tendency to, let me be sure nice of this at work, but that has a tendency to define for me the purpose of the book of Hebrews is here in chapter 4 and verse 1. When the writer says, "Let us fear, therefore, lest haply a promise being left of entering into his rest, any one of you seem to have come short of it," what comparison is he making here? What has he been talking about in chapter 3 and such alike as that, that he would make this statement? So,
but isn't he drawing a parallel here between Israel exiting Egypt and how many people fell short of actually making the promised land?
Right. Right. So of the accountable people that left the land of Egypt, how many made it into the promised land? Two, right? And so he's made this comparison throughout here, and I think specifically in chapter 3, about these people who were in the Exodus out of Egypt and heading for the promised land, but they didn't want to believe God. What did they do all the way through? They murmured and complained all the way through. They said, "What, didn't we have enough graves in Egypt that we couldn't be buried there, that you're going to bury us in the wilderness?" They wouldn't believe the things that God had to say. And God was leading them to the promised land. 40 years later, a couple of them got in. But of the ones of accountable age that left from Egypt, only two. Now, obviously, a number of people entered into the land of into the promised land, but that was the next generation, so or even further. I mean, 40 years, that's nominally two generations. Joey?
I think it's interesting to point out, since you're on this topic, yes, you're right, they murmured, and that was disobedient to God, but the very last verse of chapter 3 is the one that specifically annotates why they didn't make it in. It says, "So we see that they could not enter in because of unbelief."
Right. Yeah, yeah. And it sort of points out the difficulty sometimes of our chapter numbering that was done by Usher or whatever it is way back in the, you know, beginning of time, but with no divine inspiration as to how that would go. So obviously these two two verses go together. The whole thing goes together as a unit. You got to break it up somewhere. So chapter 4 and verse 1 is sort of what I consider his purpose in writing the book, because now he's made this comparison about the children of Israel leaving Egypt and heading toward the promised land, and now he makes it applicable to them specifically, saying that we need to be fearful. If we have a promise of entering into his rest, that we should fall short of that, because that's what they're trying to do, essentially, is falling short. And the interesting thing is that he mentions back up here, if I can find, I didn't think of it until just now, but it talks about Joshua. Let me see if I can find it here. That's not it. If I put my glasses on, I can see it. Nope, that didn't help. So anyway, there's a place, and I can't find it right now. It talks about the fact that Joshua was the one that led them into the promised land. But was the promised land ever called the land of rest? No. And he points that out in there. The promised land was not called the land of rest. But here we see in chapter 4 and verse 1 that they're going to enter in not just to the promised land, but the land of rest. There it is right there. All right. For if Joshua had given them rest, he would not have spoken afterward of another day. So we see here that when Joshua was speaking to them, encouraging them into the land and speaking to them afterward, he wasn't telling them that this was the land of promised rest. This was the land of promise. But they still had to work. They still had to do things. But we are invited to a land of rest. That's what it says right there, entering into his rest. Now, when it says his rest, whose rest are we talking about? God's rest. So what's he talking about, really? He's talking about heaven. And so, ultimately, what he's saying here is that if you reject, like the Israelites of old rejected, not only are you going back to Judaism, but you're rejecting heaven. And so that's important for them to understand and for us to understand also. Now quickly, as we look at the first four chapters of Hebrews, there's some comparisons that are made in there. And my class will know this, and see if yours does. In chapter 1, what two comparisons, major comparisons, do we have in there? All right, Jesus and the angels. In verse 1, what is the comparison there? It's the prophets, okay? I guess it's not a comparison, really, because it doesn't talk about Jesus and the prophets, but it talks about the prophets of old, okay? So there's a thought here that the prophets are something that now have been succeeded by something that's better, okay? Now, in chapter 1, go ahead, Joey. Right.
So there really is a comparison in that sense. He used to speak to us this way, now he speaks to us this
right,
way.
Right, right. He used to speak to us this way, but now he speaks to us this way. Okay? And though we don't have the word better right here, it is better. And it talks about that when we go through the chapter. Now, as has been mentioned, there's in chapter 1, there's a comparison between Jesus and the angels. In what aspect of Jesus are we comparing here in chapter 1? His superiority in what role? Jesus is a dual person, dual personality person, as it were. What role of Jesus are we talking about here? Yeah.
King.
But was Jesus a physical king? He was a spiritual king. Thank you. Okay. It's the the comparison that's being made here is Jesus with the angels in his spiritual or godhood aspect. Now, chapter 1 is how does Jesus compare, essentially as it is in heaven, against the angels or with the angels? And it shows that he is better, superior. Okay. And now, though, when we go to chapter 2, we still have a comparison of Jesus with the angels, but in what aspect here? Jared? Yes, as a man, okay? So we're comparing the human aspect of Jesus against the angels. And in chapter 2, he says even the human characteristic or character of Jesus is better than the angels. So already in the first two chapters, we've got three comparisons made from the prophets, that they are superseded by Jesus Christ, as it were. A comparison between Jesus as God to the angels, showing him to be superior. And a comparison in chapter 2, then, of Jesus as a man compared to the angels, showing that he is superior. Now we get in chapter 3, who or what are we comparing? Go ahead, Jared. Moses. So, in chapter 3, we're comparing Jesus with Moses. And how does Jesus compare with Moses? Better. Very good. That was a guess, wasn't it? What? Yeah, Joey.
He's clearly superior, but that's a theme throughout all of us. But the analogy he's drawing there is that they fulfilled similar functions.
Right. Right. But in the household of God, excuse me?
3 and 4. For this man was counted more worthy of glory than Moses, inasmuch as he that built a house hath more honor than a house. For every house is built by some man, but he that built all things is God.
Right. Okay. When we come down to this house that's being mentioned here, We're not talking certainly here about a physical house. We're talking about the household or the family, you might say, of God. In the family of God, how are Moses and Jesus compared? In what relationships in the family or in the household are they compared? Yeah. Moses is the servant. Jesus is the son. Okay. So we see that Jesus is the inheritor. Moses is the servant that brings forth. So, though they fulfill similar roles, Jesus by far is better than Moses. And that's an important relationship, I think, that's developed in chapter 3. So we have chapter 1, the prophets and Jesus as God. Chapter 2, Jesus as man. And chapter 3, Moses. And then when we get into chapter 4, who do we bring up? I think it's 4. It's not 4. It's 5. But anyway, forget I said that. In chapter 4, we have then the reason for, once again in verse 1, the reason for the writing of the book. So they should not seem to have come short of that. And then in chapter 5, who do we talk about? Jared. Yeah, you got to come up with his name, though.
Melchizedek.
Okay, Melchizedek. All right. So, how many times is the name Melchizedek used in the Bible? And in that, make the comparison between the Old Testament and the New Testament. No ideas. I looked it up. Three-ish. Turns out that the name Melchizedek is used 10 times in the Bible. But only two of those are in the Old Testament, and only once is in the story about Melchizedek in the book of Genesis, and the other one is in the book of Psalms. But 8 other times it's used here in the book of Hebrews, and that's all. Okay. But the interesting thing is, and we discussed this in my class, is that here we have just a huge thing when it comes to the New Testament, Melchizedek, yet we go back to the Old Testament origin of this, and he's mentioned in like 3 verses. Who can tell me the story of Melchizedek and the backstory behind it? It looked like Jonathan was going to put his hand up there. No, he wasn't?
When Lot had gotten captured in the city of Sodom, taken captive, Abraham and his servants went out and conquered the people that had taken them captive, freed everybody on their way back to the land. Melchizedek met them, so Abraham gave them, I think, the priest of God, attended the spoils, so it's been day to day.
Right, they mentioned that he is the priest of God Most High. So, but Melchizedek was the king of what? How does that equate to something we know today? Jerusalem. What does Jerusalem mean? Jerusalem. What is, pardon? Salem, the Hebrew word shalom, means peace. Peace of the Jebusites, okay? So, Melchizedek was a Hebrew priest, right? No, he was a heathen priest. But he was not a Hebrew, he was a Jebusite, because he was the king of the city called Peace of the Jebusites. And that's the comparison that's being made here in the book of Hebrews that actually we'll get to better in chapter 7, and though it's mentioned in chapters 5 and 6. The thing is that Melchizedek was not a Hebrew. He was not a person appointed by God in the Levitical priesthood, because obviously the Levitical priesthood had not yet been set up. And so he wasn't in some sort of lineage that had to do with the Hebrews. Okay, Roy, you had your hand up. Well, that's, I just used the heathen as opposed to a person that's of God's chosen people. Oh, as far as in when we get to the Jewish religion later on, which is much later than what we're talking about now. I mean, we're at Abraham right here. So we still have Isaac and Jacob and Joseph and all the people there. And then finally Moses. This is like 500 years later, 600 years later, something like that. But anyway, how are the priests chosen in the Jewish religion? Who's the priestly tribe? The tribe of Levi, okay? And of the tribe of Levi, there's one line in there that's chosen to be the high priest. And whose descendants are those? Aaron's descendants, okay? So we have the tribe of Levi, and out of that, all those people can be priests. But of the people that are of the tribe of Levi, those that are descendants of Aaron only can be the high priest. And we've discussed high priests in here also. So, Randy? It would so appear, yeah.
But just, I don't understand, it seems like that's a jump in logic. If he was the king of Salem, it doesn't seem he was the king of Jerusalem. It's the king of Salem.
Right.
But they weren't necessarily the same.
Obviously, that's an extra biblical, you know, factoid type thing, but the people who have studied things like that say that the only city that was called Salem was later called Jerusalem. So they weren't calling it Jerusalem at that time, just like they weren't calling Abraham at that time. His name was Abram.
I just mean, the Jebusites controlled that city at the time of Abraham.
They controlled the whole land. As a matter of fact, the only people of God's chosen people that were in the land that at that time were who? Abraham and his direct relatives. So they were the only chosen people. So when we get right down to it, we look at the people that are in the land of Palestine or in the land of Canaan at that time. We see the only people that were of God's chosen people were Abraham and his relatives, Lot and his family, Abraham and his family.
But it does mention this king in Genesis 14.
Right. Yeah, well, they were all city-states at that time. They're very much like the early, Greek nation. There wasn't really a nation. They were all city-states. So an interesting book to read, and how much fact there is behind it, I don't know, but a book by James Michener called The Source talks about how people, for example, warred at the time of Abraham. It says that, when it says that, because in the story about Lot, it says, what, five kings went out against six or something? It was a confederation of kings that came down and raided Sodom and took away Lot and all the people and the goods and stuff like that. And so when we think of six kings getting together and then Abraham getting his folks together and five other kings or vice versa, whichever it was, we think, well, yeah, you got an army of a million here marching along, and then Abraham's got his army of 175 million, and they're going and they're clashing in the tanks and, you know, bombs and everything all over the place. The fact of the matter is that these cities were small. They all had kings. And when King Melchizedek took his army out, he may have taken all 10 of his men out to go fight against the other kings who came against him with all 7 of his army. You know, we're not talking about huge magnitudes of people here. Now, if we look at just sort of the context around there in Genesis, we can see that it appears there were a number of people. I mean, there certainly had to be sufficient number of people to capture all the people in Sodom and keep them under control while they took them off north somewhere. So there probably, you know, had to be, you know, hundreds of people or something like that. But we're not talking about gazillions of people in the armies here. So they're all city-states. And so the king of Salem was here, and the king of so-and-so was here, and the king of some, they're all listed there. They're all kings. And they probably all had cities that may have had 100 or 200 people in them, for all we know. Joey?
Let me clarify something for me. Did I understand you correctly? Did you say that Melchizedek was a heathen? I'm trying to understand some of the terms there, because during the days of Melchizedek, we didn't have God's chosen people yet. So there's no Jew and Gentile contrast at that point in time.
But Melchizedek... Melchizedek. In general, it simply refers to those that somebody that is not part of God's chosen people. Now,
but does it make sense to even talk about God's chosen people in the days of Melchizedek? That's prior to God even having chosen people.
No, God had chosen Abraham in the Ur of the Chaldees.
So you're using the phrase chosen people to refer to the patriarchs.
Am right. Am I understanding that correctly? He had chosen... Pardon?
He was the very beginning. There weren't very many chosen
people. No, there weren't very many chosen people. Just a handful. And they were what later on became called the Hebrews, okay? But Melchizedek was not a Hebrew. His name is not a Hebrew name. Melchizedek was...
acceptable to God, though, if he's a king and a priest. I mean,
well, yeah, because it says that he was a priest of God Most High.
Right, so and in that sense, he's chosen of God for that.
Right.
For the roles he fulfilled.
Well, he could very well have been saying something like, I am the priest of God Most High, and taking it upon himself. But we see later on in the discussion in Hebrews that that's not the case, because it says in matter of fact, it is the lesser that gives to the better. So it shows that Melchizedek was better than Abraham, even though the Levites were in the loins of Abraham at that time, it says. Okay, Gary?
I think the fact that there's a lack of information about his lineage leaves a lot to speculate. We can't trace it back to a physical lineage that he deserved to be king, which is precisely the comparison. There's two comparisons
right.
being made in this chapter. One is Melchizedek to Christ. Christ had no bloodline that made him be king. It was a special anointment or gift that God had chosen.
Right.
And we see the same in Melchizedek. The second comparison that's being made is, as great as they thought Abraham was, Abraham recognized him as superior by tithing to him.
Right.
So the comparison then to Christ would lead us to say that we owe him that respect. I think to go too far beyond that gets us into grounds where we're speculating a lot. It's not really directly to the point of the chapter.
No, exactly. And the thing is that I think that this is perhaps why Melchizedek is used so little in the Old Testament and used a lot in the New Testament, is because he wants to make that precise comparison, is that we have no information here. But obviously, Jesus and Melchizedek are related in the same way in their standing as being priest, according to the law of the Jews. John. King, but not priest.
Right, yeah, that's what I meant.
Right. So Yeah, Mickey and I were studying with somebody once, and we mentioned that, well, you know, if Jesus were on earth at this time, he couldn't be priest. They said, you're saying that Jesus, if he was here, right here, he couldn't be priest? I say, yeah. So
later on, it's, the point is made again about the New Testament, the Old Testament.
Right.
A new covenant.
Right.
Because he couldn't have been a king, strictly for that reason.
Oh, yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
Priest.
I
keep saying the same king.
I know it. Yeah.
Just kick me, John, next time I say that.
I was talking to somebody today, I forget what it was, and he kept saying, well, and this is, you know, chapter 25. You go, no, it's chapter 24. Yeah, I know, and then it's chapter 25. No, it's chapter 24. Get it? Okay, Carolyn.
Joey was commenting regarding the term heathen. I think we think of heathen as the same as pagan, which is the kind of crazy, you know, stuff going on.
Yeah.
Around the fire, half naked or whatever. I mean, it was something that God accepted for what it was at that time.
Right. And I think, as Gary points out, we can speculate, you know, right and left, and we've gotten into probably too much speculation here, but the thing is that we have no knowledge of Melchizedek other than the original story that says that he was priest of God Most High. Abraham appeared to acknowledge that, and he gave him a tithe. And we'll discuss that, you'll discuss that in chapter 7, I think. So so that anyway is what I wanted to bring up, and obviously we went too far, but still. So the thing is that in this semi-review, when we get to chapter 5, what we're talking about, what we introduce is that we're talking about Jesus as high priest, and you'll remember that just before this, it talks about him as being the great high priest, and I think Mickey mentioned that in his lesson when you were back in chapter 4. It talks about Jesus not only being just a high priest, but a great high priest. And no other priests are referred to as great high priests. So once again, this is showing that Jesus is better than the high priest, okay? And so he's developing the discussion in chapter 5 about Jesus as high priest. And he brings up Melchizedek because he's going to show the importance of this later. And so right now he just says, in verse 10 there, named a high priest after the order of Melchizedek. And that's it. That's all he says in chapter 5. You go, well, what about it? And he'll bring it up again in chapter 7 and explain it further. Chris, did you have your hand halfway up? Or? Okay, all right. So disregarding Melchizedek, but regarding the high priest, when we look at chapter 1 and the comparison with the prophets, chapter 1 and the comparison of Jesus as God against the angels, or compared to the angels, chapter 2 of Jesus as man compared to the angels, chapter 3 of Jesus and Moses compared, in chapter 5 and part of chapter 4 talking about Jesus as high priest, why does the writer use these specific terms or characters in discussing what he wants to discuss with these Hebrew Christians?
Well, he's appealing to their culture, their past, everything that they know. He's leveraging their understanding of the old law to his advantage, which is to teach them about Christ.
Okay, Randy? That's true. And he...
You want to go back to the old way, but there's no reason to go back to the old way.
Right.
Your high priests have been imperfect.
Yeah.
We now have a perfect one. There's a direct hand of God. There's no reason to continue with your high priest.
Okay. And we'll develop that in chapter 7. Jenny?
He's also making comparisons with people or things that they respect and have high regard for. So it would be...
That's like what I was fishing for. Right.
Or to any of the gods at the time, and how he's even better than God.
Right. So when it comes right down to it, when we look at the prophets, the angels, Moses, and the high priest, and here in chapter 6, finally he talks about Abraham. When we talk about these people are the foundation of the Jewish religion. Joey?
The marks of a great teacher is to, appeal to what people already know, to give them food for thought, to, get them excited, or if you will, appeal to the, I don't know how to exactly say it, but, we're back to the principle like when in Rome, we also see a Paul talking about the unknown God. He goes, I'll tell you about the unknown God. He's the true and living God.
Yeah.
See all that throughout the book of Hebrews, where he's, like you said, he's capitalizing on their pre-existing knowledge,
yep.
Basically, leveraging that to teach them about Christ.
Yeah.
Like Jenny said, rightly so. These are he's referring to people that they respect.
Right.
And using that to his advantage to get their attention and whet their appetite.
When we look at the whole makeup, you might say, of of the Jewish religion, we see that. Here's Moses, the deliverer of the law. Here's the angels through whom the law was also brought and certified and things like that. Here's the prophets who spoke about things. Here's the high priest who was the one that made atonement for all of them. And the writer of Hebrews is saying that Jesus and the new law are better than they. So he lays it all out. In very good order, I think. John?
You danced around a lot, but I think the reason they brought up Melchizedek is because the very large source of tithe for them was Abraham was the father.
Yeah.
If they showed them that Melchizedek was greater than Abraham, because Abraham was given the tithe, but even greater than your father that you're so proud to be on.
Okay. Yeah. He's starting to turn the corner right here when he talks to Melchizedek. We'll talk about Melchizedek. He's going to turn it and make this comparison and show exactly that. I just lost the whole thought. Maybe it'll come back to me. Actually, I just lost my whole brain. So he's going to develop Melchizedek as we get through here. But you'll notice that in chapter 6, there's not a whole lot of discussion about Melchizedek except in the last verse. But starting in chapter 7 and verse 1, then we have the discussion about Melchizedek and the comparison between him and Jesus. And that's the real story of what's going on here. Okay. So that, I think, is the way that the writer of the book of Hebrews has outlined things so far. Terry started off last week then in verse 9 of chapter 6, talking about brethren were persuaded better things of you, and trying to get through verse 20, but managed to get down to verse 13 where we introduce Abraham, another important character in the Jewish religion. Joey?
John raises an interesting point when he talks about the fact that the scriptures are basically saying here that Melchizedek was greater than Abraham. And guess what? Christ is like Melchizedek. So guess what? Christ is better than Abraham too.
Yeah.
And you have Jesus saying, before Abraham was, I am. you see how what their reaction was in that case. So again, just another example of the better or the superiority of Christ, even over Abraham, which they adore.
Right. I remember what it was that I forgot. I'm not sure I can pop it in right here, but Jesus had accused the Jews of being servants of their father, the devil, and they said, "We've never been servants of anybody." The Jews had a great misunderstanding of their relationship with the world, I think. They had been servants ever since their kingdoms were taken away when they got taken away into Babylonian captivity. Really, the start of their servitude was when the Assyrians came down and assaulted the northern 10 tribes. They just don't seem to understand who they are and what their relationship is with other people. They seem to be divorced from the world somehow. I'm not sure, John. They had their beginnings in Egypt. That's true. That's right. And I'm not sure what you'd call that, but I think the Bible does, as Joey mentions, calls it slaves. Yeah.
Even in the time of Christ, you know, they were subject to Roman law. They were not, if you will, running the show. They were subservient to the Romans and the Roman law in the time of Christ.
Sure. Roy? Yeah, in the American Standard Version, like you say, it says after the order of Melchizedek. And if you go back into how the Levites are set up, it talks about the order of this family and the order of that family and the order of this family. What it is just the lineage. I mean, the descendants of really is what we're talking about. So all he's saying is he's like Melchizedek in some way. And so it's as though he's part of Melchizedek's family. He's not, but he's making the comparison here. Okay, so when he says after the order of, he's simply saying after the lineage of, or in this instance, after the likeness of.
And the similarity of likeness.
Similarity.
I think I pointed out in my lesson a few Sundays ago, look at the things that they shared in common. Melchizedek was the only character that served more than one role. He was priest and king.
Yeah. I will go with David. Saul.
Well,
all the kings of Israel.
Didn't function though as high priest.
No, that's true. He was not. Yeah.
And then also the other similarity is without beginning, without end.
Right.
And he makes that point, I think, in Hebrews 7.
Yeah.
After the order of means they had similar characters.
Yeah, that's all. So, and it's. It's sort of an archaic usage of that. I mean, perhaps in one of the, if we go to one of the other versions of the Bible, we'll find that they use some other, let's go to some perverted version of the Bible here and look at, what?
Order, I haven't studied that particular word, but when they talk about, you know, they'll talk about a religious order, like a certain type of monk or, you know, the Franciscan order.
Yeah.
I
think it's the same thing that they're sort of the. When I think of order there, it's more in the relationship of club, though we're not talking club here. I mean, but it's an organizational structure. And I think that's what we're talking about here. Now, if we go to the contemporary English version, it says Jesus has gone there ahead of us and he is our high priest forever, just like Melchizedek. That's the comparison he's trying to make. I wouldn't buy these words, but, you know, it's more contemporary words. So, okay. See, if I beat around the bush long enough, it'll be time to quit. But anyway, but I think it's important for us as we go through this book, because in the other class, we're going through it apparently more slowly than you because we're only in chapter 5. But this is essentially a verse-by-verse study of the book of Hebrews. Well, it's necessary for us occasionally to drop back and say, what's the whole context here that we're talking about? And so it's the better stuff. It's the hope you don't fall short stuff. It's the comparison of Jesus to all these people and functions and how they compare to the law that these people are trying to go back to, or some of them are trying to go back to anyway. Chris? Right.
And the application for us today is not that we're tempted to go back to Judaism, but the fact that we're tempted to go back to what we left behind and would not be out with the teaching of Jesus in 962 about no man putting his hands in the plow and looking back is fit for the kingdom of God.
Right.
Whether it be Judaism, whether it be worldliness, whether it be denominationalism, whatever we left behind, there isn't always a temptation.
And I, I think the New Testament alludes to that in a number of instances about people, you know, does more than allude to it, but talks about the kind of people you were and the type of people that you are, but also in other places talks about the fact that you don't want to go back to the way that you were. And in the same thing that they're talking about here is when he writes to these Christians that are Hebrews of, you know, you don't want to do this. You're giving up the best thing for something that's less than best. You've already got it. Why murmur and complain and be stopped at the border of the promised land? All right. One thing, Terry mentioned this just sort of peripherally last week when discussing, when introducing verses 9 through 20 about the fact that we have a change in tone here. And I just wanted to read you what Dan King says in his commentary on Hebrews about this, because it's interesting to note, because just as we've just as we've looked at here, the writer of Hebrews in our review, we've seen that he's trying to show them all of these aspects of the Jewish religion and how Jesus and the New Testament are better than those things. But now, here in verses 9 through 20, he essentially reverses that. And so Dan says, he says, having said all of this, as he was introducing verses 9 through 12, there is now a marked change of tone in the writer's comments and sentiments. At this juncture, the author lets his correspondents in on his secret thoughts. He has every confidence that they will react positively to his words and warnings, and that they will ultimately survive this formidable challenge. Now, that's a good thing for us to look at here, because, or to understand here, because there are a number of places, starting in chapter 1 all the way through here, where the writer sort of steps aside from what he's talking about and makes an application, rather than just going through the historical stuff. He stops what he's talking about and makes this sort of a parenthetical expression. Here he's making quite a sidestep for, relatively speaking, quite a number of verses, as it were, before he goes back to his admonition for them not to go back to being Jews. Someone knock on the door in the back and tell them they got 5 minutes. Here, once again, he's got a sort of a parenthetical expression. Can't talk and do my pager at the same time. Another parenthetical expression that is sort of, as Dan King mentions here, is sort of opposed to what he's been saying. He's been admonishing them all through to stop being weird people and trying to go back to Judaism and stay with Jesus Christ and the new covenant. You've got to do this. Don't fall short. And now he says, but beloved, we are persuaded. Now he's saying, beloved. Now, the word beloved is used quite a number of times in the New Testament, associated very frequently with whose writings? Paul's, okay? Paul very frequently refers to the people to whom he's writing as beloved. That, you know, this doesn't go to prove that Paul wrote the book or that he didn't write the book, but, you know, the writer of the book of Hebrews wrote this word at God's persuasion. And so the thing is now he's sort of giving them a break from the admonition to show them that he has every confidence in them, that the things that he said and the things that he'll say later will convince them to stay where they are, which is with the Lord, rather than to go back to the law of Moses. And so it's sort of an endearing phrase here. Now from 9 through 20, he says, you guys are going to make it. But once again, admonishes them to keep on keeping on, as it were. Terry broke this up into three pieces, 9 and 10 and 11 and 12, and then 13 through 20. And he had a a reason for each one, but I'd have to pop in the CD and play it again in order to remember what he said. But I think it was 9 and 10 is that there were better things being persuaded, and 11 and 12 that they're going to show diligence, and number 13 through 20 is that God remembers his promises or something like that. So it's good for us to remember that even though we're being admonished and admonished and admonished, that the person that's writing the book is writing to us in such a way that we understand that we are the beloved. And so he's not trying to just push us into the ground, but he's got to make his point, because these people are turning away from that which is better, and they shouldn't be doing that. And so he calls them beloved. We're persuaded better things of you. Well, look, there's that word better. So in this instance, it's not referring to a comparison between the Old Covenant and the New Covenant, but rather the fact that these people are better than he's sort of been pointing them out to be. Or at least he hopes they're better. He's convinced, he's persuaded that these people will be better, and that they will do the things that accompany salvation. If they don't do the things that accompany salvation, because they go back to the law of Moses, then they will not enter into that land of rest that we spoke about in chapter 4 and verse 1. So he says that they need to keep on, when he says in verse 11 that they need to show the same diligence to keep on even to the end. Verse 12, that they're not sluggish, but they be imitators of them who through faith and patience inherit the promises. So once again, we're looking back to the older people in their knowledge who have inherited the promises through their faith and their patience. So we could look at Joshua and Caleb. You know, they inherited the promises. In other words, they got to go into the promised land because of their faith and their patience. And so I think he's talking about people like that. And he may be even talking about people that they know personally who died in the Lord, that they had been, you know, admonished about in the book of 1 Thessalonians, that indeed they needed to not be concerned about those people that had died in the Lord. So I mentioned something about verse 12, and Terry got to verse 13 last time, so there we are, right back where you started, where you ended with. So next week, I believe Mickey will be here next Wednesday, but then he'll be gone again for another couple of weeks or something like that, so there'll be other teachers here and there. But start again then at verse 13 of chapter 6. Thanks.